And I think there may be a couple of quick announcements. Anybody have an announcement here?
Saturday.
You want to announce Saturday?
Yes.
Yeah, I will, unless someone else would like to. In response to President Obama's announcement of a new war in Iraq and Syria, we've called a protest at Park Street Station Saturday at 1 p.m. And we actually printed enough flyers that hopefully you will help each take a pile of flyers and get them out. We have just 2 days to do this rally. We want to get a response out there quickly. Of course, we have two beheaded American journalists, and they're whipping up the frenzy as usual. And so we have a lot of work to do to reach the bulk of the American people who still think that there might be something we have to do militarily against ISIS. So let's get out there and get a protest. Let's get out and pass these around.
Thank you, Cole.
This time we take 5 or 10 instead of 1.
Okay, so let's, I don't see any other announcements. Let's launch into our discussion.
I have recognized this gentleman. Go ahead.
I applaud your perspective. I think right on all the things that I can understand. But I want to make a point about water. This point, most of the plunder focus has been on resources in the past, the technological ability to reduce our dependence on. We can do with less oil. We have lots of ways of producing alternatives. We don't have any alternative for potable water. It's not just water, it's potable water. When we get to a point where people turn their faucets on and the water that comes out is not drinkable, it's not useful for cooking because it's chemically polluted, as will be the case with fracking chemicals that are moving surely closer to groundwater. I believe that potable water
right now, the world's fresh water, we're talking about fresh water. Right now, 70% is used worldwide for irrigation to grow food. 15% is for drinking water, municipal use, drinking and sewage. This is worldwide. And 15% for industry, of which the biggest user is the energy industry. So the amount that this and the supply is not going to grow in most of the world. It's going to diminish. The population is going to grow by another 1 billion or 2 billion people. On the track we're on now, in response to your question, this number for energy alone you can't reduce that. So this is going to drop by to 55% will be available to grow food. Why is energy alone doubling its extraction of water? Fracking, coal plants, and nuclear plants. These are now the biggest, becoming the biggest uses of water to cool the cooling systems. In the United States, the percentages are energy alone is 49%. Can you believe that? And the rest is everything else. And this is going to increase because of fracking. So there are parts of the country now where farmers are in a fight, and usually a losing fight, with oil companies for what little water there is, like in California and West Texas. This is the future. We're going to have to choose between having oil for our cars and water to grow food. So this is another, yet another reason why addressing the fossil fuel domination of our lives is so crucial. Please.
Well, I was just going to mention, as
I come from farmers in the Midwest, and they're facing this incredible issue of not having railroad cars available to transport grain.
Yeah, I've read about that.
And so, right, so corn and things are rotting on the ground because they can't move them. Because the priority is on using the railways to transport the oil from North Dakota.
So what the U.S. is a grain surplus country, one of the very few. Argentina, Australia, Russia and Ukraine and Canada are the only countries that have enough of a grain surplus to satisfy the needs of countries around the world which have a grain deficiency, like all of Africa, North Africa and the Middle East. So what happens when the grain rots is the supply available on the international market diminishes, the price goes up, and therefore providing the basic staple of bread to populations around the world, it becomes much more expensive. And it's the price of food rather than pure scarcity that's driving people over the edge. I saw your hand. Yeah, you'll be next.
Can you address the actual cost of energy used for wars and the war machine? And how much of the energy resources...
Yeah, it's a little hard to do that. The U.S. military, if the U.S. military were a country, it would probably be around the 25th biggest user of oil, roughly. It's the reason why it's a little hard to calculate that, because U.S. forces overseas get their oil from Kuwait, from Saudi Arabia, from other... They don't bring it from here. They get it there, and it's harder to track that data. But the U.S. military is a major consumer of energy. Now I have an ethical problem to throw out at you, okay? Because of the war in Afghanistan, where it became very difficult to get them oil, they had to do it by tanker truck through the Khyber Pass, which was attacked by insurgents. And the Pakistanis closed the path to protest drone strikes. So it cost $200 per gallon for the U.S. to supply oil to their forces in Afghanistan. As a result, the U.S. military, and also because everything I said they know too, everything I said, they've published studies on this. They understand that getting enough oil to have the high-tech military that they want, each new plane, each new tank uses 4 to 10 times more oil than the one before. That's, you know, they can do flip-flops at 2,000 miles an hour. Imagine how much oil they're burning up. So the average GI today uses 50 times more oil per soldier per day than a World War II soldier. That's a rough order of magnitude, okay? So what are they doing? They are investing a lot of money in energy alternatives and renewables, solar power especially, and biofuels. This is the ethical question. Do we applaud them for... See, nobody else in the government could get away with this because of congressional, you know, the deniers. But the military says it's a national security issue. We have to be able to fight anywhere where there's drought, where there's climate change. So they're preparing for the world that I described. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I've been to the war college where they talk about everything I said. They will repeat that to you. So do we applaud them for taking the leadership in technology which has civilian use, or do we decry this behavior because it's going to make it easier for them to fight future Afghanistan? I don't know the answer to that, but you're free to express your opinion. I did recognize somebody over here, but we could come back
but
to this.
In terms of my question, it's not just U.S. military, it's military in general uses huge amounts of energy, and also the industries that supply and, yeah, and
yes,
support the military.
Absolutely.
So war itself is just,
it's environmentally dangerous in so many other ways.
Right.
Absolutely. But the biggest problem in terms of climate change is not the military, it's cars. And the growing population of cars and air conditioners. And here's another ethical question. I've given this talk in China and in Mexico, and people say to me, well, you have your car and your air conditioner, why can't we have those things? And we can't afford to buy a Prius, by the way. I say, they say, we can't afford a Prius. We need an old gas guzzler because that's cheap. What do we say to them? We say, no, you can't have that because that's going to make the climate worse. Or do we say, well, you know, what I think we have to say is, you don't get cars and we're going to retire ours in time. Or something along those lines. This is the way we're going to have to address the future, because increasingly, the greenhouse gases are not going to come from the industrialized country. They're going to come from China and India, Brazil, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, Argentina, where people are moving up to a middle-class quality of life. They all watch American television. They'll tell you this in China. We see all your movies and TV shows. And we want what you have. That's a good life. Now, mind you, what they see is what Hollywood projects is the American way of life. Everybody has a big house in the suburbs with two or three cars and maybe a yacht, you know, and a swimming pool. This is what they see. They want that too. And how do we respond to their desire for those things? If we don't solve that, we don't solve climate change. That's why I say this is an international problem. We, in this country, have got to be able to say, we hear you. You can't all have big gas guzzlers because we'll all perish together. So we're going to show you how to live without gas guzzlers. This is our mission. Yes, please.
Many years ago, I went to an environmental conference at Goddard College, and one of the suggestions there was they were trying to pass a law that any industry that pollutes a stream has to have its intake pipe downstream from its effluent pipe. In other words, it's experiencing the consequences of its evil action.
Yeah.
So I keep thinking about that in terms of this country and our politicians. How do we make them suffer for what they're doing to the world rather than, you know, everybody else suffer? And then a smaller question, do you have any idea of how much energy clothes dryers use? Because I don't use one.
I do not know the answer to that question.
Because it seems to me a total waste.
Yeah. There many people have told me that, and I have neighbors who got rid of their washing machine, and I see their laundry hanging out my window, my neighbors, for this reason. So there must be enough of an environmental consequence that people are making that change. Like, we're all making changes of one sort or another.
In Cambridge and Amherst.
What's that?
In Cambridge and in Amherst.
Well, Northampton. I wanted to say something else about what you said. We have to elect green candidates. Whether they're a member of the existing party or a green party, who will pass legislation that makes that necessary. Or we have to shame the companies or boycott them. You know the methods as well as I do. But there was something else I wanted to say. Oh, airplanes. this is a problem we're going to have to face. I have enjoyed traveling around the world and visiting friends in California and the like, and airplanes are becoming one of the fastest growing producers of carbon dioxide emissions, and are expected, because airplane travel is booming around the world, become much more so in the future. So that's like driving cars, and another issue much bigger than washing machines. Let me just put it that way. Yes?
What about the amount of money that Germany, China, Denmark are spending on solar? I mean, when will solar be competitive with fracking? I mean, eventually it's going to have to get cheaper, don't you think? Or do you disagree?
Apples and oranges. Step back. Solar power does compete with fracked natural gas. This natural gas, among its uses, is to generate electricity. When I said apples and oranges, most of the oil companies now are giving up on natural gas because they're not making enough gazillion dollars. They're moving all their rigs to the Eagle Ford and Bakken Formation in North Dakota, Eagle Ford in Texas, to frack for oil. The gas still is big, but that's no longer the cutting edge. It's fracking for oil that they're interested in, because there's so much money, more money in that. And that's so that we could drive cars. And until we have an electrically driven transportation system, we're still going to need liquid fuels, oil. The problem in this country is cars. And to the degree that other countries follow in our footsteps, that's where the problem is going to become. In China, it's coal, and it's to produce electricity. And they want to now move to increase solar, but also nuclear, big time, and fracking for natural gas, except that the limit on fracking is going to be water. They don't have enough water. So this is not a matter of cost. It's a matter of public policy and infrastructure. So solar is already competitive in many areas, like in Germany, and wind is even more competitive. But there are all kinds of policies in place that perpetuate dependence on oil and natural gas. I could talk as much about this as you want, but that's it. The big test is going to be China's now debating its next five-year plan. And the talk is in Beijing that the Communist Party leadership is now thick in debate about. They understand they have to stop burning coal, or the population will rise up in rebellion against them. And I say hallelujah to that. They know that this will happen. The urban population in Beijing and Shanghai and the big cities will rise up if they don't reduce coal pollution. So they are planning to move more rapidly than we thought away from coal. But what's unknown, they haven't decided yet how to divide it up between nuclear, wind, and solar fracked gas. And so that's why I say we have to collaborate with our fellow environmentalists and peace people in China to push them away from nuclear, I believe, and fracked gas, and put all of their chips in the solar and wind. If they do that, that will be revolutionary and could be the change, because they're on such a large scale. Please, and then you'll be next.
So that we have the technological knowledge and that it's a political issue, not technological. So what is the technological solution for the car issue you just mentioned? I hear so many things about the bad things, the battery, the EVs, and hydrogen.
First and foremost, it's public transportation. First and foremost. Because if you don't have that, then people will cling to their cars. and you know that we don't have trains where I live. There's one train a day. One. Of course we used to. Yeah. There used to be trolley tracks. You could go from Maine, far up in Maine, to Philadelphia by trolley, by changing trolleys. And every community in between had electric trolleys. They were all torn down by the oil companies in conjunction with the electricity company, you know, with everybody else. Car companies and the oil companies, not the electricity companies, conspired to rip up the old interurban systems, as they were called. You can still see the tracks all over. Boston still has some, but it was once universal. We've gone backwards in the past 100 years. So public transit provided by electricity, subways, buses, electrical driven buses, and high-speed rail. That's the technical answer. You go to China, people are buying cars, but if as they start increasing the taxes is what they're doing, you could go anywhere in China now, almost virtually anywhere, by subway to a high-speed rail station and be whisked at 300 kilometers an hour to wherever you want to go. An unbelievable high-speed rail system. They are. We've gone back 100 years. They've leaped 100 years into the future in 10 years. I had recognized, yeah.
You said it's a political question, and that the U.S. and China and a number of other countries that you mentioned must agree. What's the agreement going to be? What's the plan politically to divide up the remaining carbon emissions or whatever? What's the contours of that?
Well, I was talking about something a little bit different. I can't tell you because I don't know what's been going on in the closed-door negotiations around the UN summit that starts the week after next. Between who is there? I don't know. Obama is going to meet with President Xi Jinping, I think, next month. Maybe they'll work on this. I was thinking of something else. There are agreements between the U.S. and China forged by President Obama in 2009 and then President Hu Jintao, extraordinary agreements for cooperation in the development of electric cars, of carbon sequestration, of energy efficiency, half a dozen other agreements to partner university and university, corporation and corporation, government agency and agency. And because of the friction that I talked about and the stupid goddamn pivot to Asia, which has pushed the Chinese understandably into a hostile stance towards the United States, those agreements have not been carried through with, but they're there on paper. If you look up the 2009 November Obama-Hu Jintao summit energy agreements, you will read them. They are quite remarkable. Yes, please.
In terms of technical quick fixes, one of the things I've heard you talk about cars and airplanes. Of course, very difficult to reduce because nobody wants to give up a car. But and the same thing is going to be true about animal agriculture.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, wouldn't you say that animal agriculture is at least equal in stature to cars and airplanes?
No, not equal in stature. About two-thirds of all carbon emissions come from the burning of fossil fuels. So one-third is all everything else. Now, a big part of that is deforestation, which often contributes to animal agriculture, like in the Amazon, and for meat farming itself. So it's certainly less than a third, whereas cars are a much bigger part of the problem.
I guess about a third is what I've been hearing.
Yeah. However, because everything I've talked about, I started out by saying that one of the I spoke about rise in consumption in China and India. They are, you know, 25 years ago, people in China and India, if they ate meat, it was on holidays, you know, once a week. Now they want to have as much beef in their diet as we do because they see all the American advertising. They see what we in quotation marks, eat in their TVs. They see us eating a steak a day, right? That's what, don't you all have a steak? And they want to duplicate that. And the only way to do that is in huge factory farms. There isn't grazing land. So this is going to substantially contribute to fossil fuels. I wanted to say something else that you said. I'll come back to me. Something about other things. Cars, planes, meat production. Yeah. There are other things. All right, I'll think of it. Please, so go other, next.
The other side of the equation, I don't know if he's alluding to that, but there's the natural sequestration of having trees and the foliage, et cetera,
right,
that were taken away as well. And
that's what I said.
So that's the other...
Yeah, deforestation.
Deforestation. Mm-hmm. Not only you create the farms, but you're taking away...
Oh, yes, you're
CO2
taking away the
sequestration.
Yes.
So
yes,
how much does that impact? Because if you had all that, then you could survive with more pollution from fossil fuels,
yeah,
right? Because you have the earth.
You know, I just read this. I just don't remember what the percentage is. I'm guessing 10 or 15%.
Is it all?
Yeah.
Because it seems like, and as the population grows, you're going to need
more
space
for
buildings, the roads, etc. So
all of that, but the fastest growing contribution to climate change is coal production in China and India.
Emissions versus
emissions. Yeah, I mean by far. So all these other things follow. Yes, please. Oh, and then you'll be next.
I'd like to try to simplify the discussion a little on the technical issues versus some of the others, because I work on climate change every day. The first priority is always...
Please correct anything that I say.
Well, whatever. You can see if I correct it or just add to it. But the point is, the first priority is always increased energy efficiency, making everything more efficient. And a key fact that's useful for North Americans to remember is that we use twice the energy per person as Europe. And Europeans, on average, live fairly well. So right away, there's a factor of two that we can do better. But worldwide, efficiency is always the first priority. It's always most cost-effective. It often enhances lifestyle, etc. So that's what we have to work on more and more. But there are many more efficient light bulbs and appliances than we use. Second point is that even in the extreme case of airline fuel, right, which is the hardest thing to make renewable, you can still make airline fuel from biomass using renewable electricity. Okay, so you literally could have a renewable airplane fuel. So even that extreme case is not surmountable.
And guess which organization is most pushing this development?
Well, whatever.
The U.S. Air Force.
Fine, that's great. I mean, it is good. All I'm saying is that the technical side, in terms of what to do, is not the issue. I agree with you completely. The problem is the speed at which we have to do it to keep temperature change under 2 degrees Celsius, which is the official target, which is probably not realizable anymore, but we can try. So it's the speed. So we have to reduce fossil fuel use worldwide by something like 6 to 8% a year, which is so fast it's hard to even conceptualize how we could do it even if we wanted to. And the flip side of that is the amount of money needed to be invested. Most of the estimates, in my opinion, are far too small. I think we would need something like $5 trillion a year in gross investment. It wouldn't cost that much, but in gross investment, to make these changes. That's the ballpark, not $1 trillion, like many people talk about. So it's the speed, it's the amount of money, it's not the technology. I agree completely.
Thank you for that. And I would add, what's often drives improvements in efficiency is the high price and taxation of fossil fuels.
Yeah, but that's the slow way. We have to just do it. We can't wait for it to be cost effective.
Yeah.
Okay. It'll take decades.
Yeah, I promised. I promised.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, go get
you're next.
So I guess what I wanted to point toward.
I'll go next. Well, actually, I have something to say that will pull together four things that have just been said, and I'm afraid I'll lose it if I don't say it.
Please go ahead.
Okay, we have used the word sequestration, but we're talking about farming, we're talking about carbon sinks, climate change, I mean, there's one more, George, help me, what are we missing? There's a whole direction that never gets mentioned, and I just want to say it here because it's the only thing that's given me hope in 10 years. And that is the fact that 200 years ago, before we had industrial agriculture, the prairies in the Middle West had soil that was 10, 12, 15 feet deep with grasses that went all the way down, and all kinds of bacterial and earthworm action, and I don't know a whole lot more about it, but a huge amount of carbon was sequestered in the soils originally. Also, Australia, before the Brits and Irish got there with their sheep, and a lot of other places. Talk about the Amazon. I have heard that over half of the excess carbon up there is because of agricultural practices that have allowed the carbon to blow away, dust bowl, wash down the Mississippi and be sitting at the bottom of the oceans. Now, yes, the issue is gas and oil and petroleum, coal, etc. But over the last 2 years, a very big contributor was agricultural practices. And so, drum roll, organic farming is our solution, but more than that, actually using livestock appropriately could sequester carbon again. But if all of us would think about how we're using our tiny little bits of land and talk to our neighbors about it, we could be sequestering carbon. We also have to stop driving SUVs, but we could be sequestering carbon. And I just want to say that as another whole lens that we can use to look at this. Yeah.
There's so much that we could all say in response. The IPCC still says that most of the carbon emissions up there is from fossil fuel consumption.
Okay.
Going back to the Industrial Revolution in the West, in the U.S. and Europe and Germany and England in the coal era, so most of it that's there now is from coal production, which is why the Chinese say, look, the climate change we see now is your fault. We have nothing to do with that. Therefore, we should get a pass for the next 10, 20 years. Now they're changing. Their attitude has changed, but that was what they said at Kyoto. Why they're not bound by the Kyoto Protocol? So, is that argument?
So I'd love to find out what the stuff I've been reading says that it's more about agriculture.
Yeah, well, it's big. Agriculture is big. Maybe you know more, but the IPCC, you know, really.
Carbon your point is good because agriculture is one of the number one users of fossil fuels.
That too, that all goes on the fertilizers,
tractors.
Agriculture is important, but it takes a long time to change the soil.
There's 15, I'll do one, say one more thing. There are 15 billion acres around the world of soils that have been degraded for one reason or another. This is not including pure deserts. But places like the American Midwest, Australia, Mexico, Argentina. If we could have organic practices on all of those acres, we could pull back all of the carbon that's a problem. And there's a bunch of scientists who say that.
Okay.
Now, that's a very
I'll have to investigate. I haven't heard that, but I'll investigate.
But I'll give you resources.
Okay.
Happy to.
I know what I wanted to say before I answer your question as someone else, maybe yours. I don't remember. Your question... The one trend that's positive in all of this is urbanization. People are moving to cities around the world. Everywhere in the world, people are moving to cities. And cities are dense cities. And the denser cities, more people live in cities, the easier it is to provide public transit, and the more car-unfriendly cities are. So my students... maybe your kids or grandkids or whatever, they all want to live in Brooklyn. It's not a mecca. Why Brooklyn? They all want to move to Brooklyn. They don't have car. You can't keep a car in New York City. They don't have cars. They don't want cars. They go by bicycle or by the subway or by bus. But this is happening around the world. People want to be in cities. In China, in India, everywhere this is happening, in Africa. And that is one hope, because it's easier to do what this gentleman, what you were saying, the more people are in cities, the easier it is to make changes quickly. So that's one positive trend. Joe.
So I wanted to kind of point to the interrelationship of the issues here. As you know, from China, Japan, especially China, when there's government policy, they can do construction and transformation rather intensely and have huge investment. And we saw this here during the Second World War when there was a transformation of the economy. So if you think about how do you get the kind of policy transformation, how do you get the investments, the one thing you're looking at, cutting the military budget where the money is, you talk about economic policy in terms of reconstructing railroads, that's jobs, that's green jobs, that's putting people back to work. So I think we need to think in terms of larger kind of social political transformation if we're going to go anywhere near hitting what we have to. And I think the place of the integration of the economic justice, peace, and environmental policy.
I agree with all of that. I also come to the view that we also have to be campaigners against the fossil fuel companies. I mean, not just saying, oh, you're, green, this and that. Well, thank you. They are not going to surrender their dominant position in the supply of energy. And if you read Exxon's most recent report on 2035, there's going to be more oil consumption than ever. And they see nothing but a bright promise for oil and natural gas looking into the future. A lot of the diesel, supplying diesel for Africans who are now buying trucks and vans, and in China and India, they're boosting their diesel production. But they are going to fight any effort we make to impose climate reductions on fossil fuels. They're going to finance the climate deniers. They've been very successful at this, using the same firms that the tobacco companies hired to do tobacco cancer deniers. Those people are the same ones they've hired to do climate denier. These people are the enemy of peace and justice and climate change, and they have to be fought. They have to be stigmatized, demonized. They're like the tobacco companies. They're like the slavers who profited from slavery. They're an evil business. And that's the way I see it. So we have to do the positive things, but we have to understand that there is an enemy. And they're going to fight hard around the world. And it's not just the private oil companies, as you probably know. It's Saudi Aramco, it's PDVSA in Venezuela, Pemex, Petrobras, China National Petroleum Corporation, Sinopec. They all are pushing oil and fossil fuels in their own country. So there has to be a global movement against the power of big fossil fuel companies. You're next.
It's a very practical, here and now suggestion, which is that everybody can get solar. With no upfront investment. I have solar panels in my house that I pay for them. I'm not terribly smart. It was terribly difficult to figure it all out. I buy my solar from my average solar company rather than the utility. And it's no down payment, no upfront costs. Everybody can do
it. Or you can invest in a community solar where it's not on your house, it could be somewhere else, but you're allowed to invest in that. Did I miss anything? You had your hand up before. And you're next.
Comment and a question. Today's September 11th.
Yes.
September 11th, 2001, and several days after, no planes were flying. Climatologists like yourself and this gentleman back here did some analysis on what the air quality was And my understanding was quite dramatically better for those days and a few days later.
Wow.
Now my question is, ozone, the ozone hole. What's your thought about that? The most recent information.
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer. Somebody else does.
What?
The thing about airplane use, and this is why if I could contribute anything, is to understand the global dimensions of all of this. Fastest growing plane transportation is in Southeast Asia, India, China, and the Middle East. Not here. I mean, we fly as much as Americans and Europeans fly, pretty much as much as we get. But in India and in China, it doubles every year, something like that. So that's what I say. We have to see our work as being international on all of these issues. Yes?
I was just wondering what argument there is for nuclear power. That it really is, you mentioned it once, you also mentioned that it's one of the largest uses of water, and but it is sometimes talked about by so-called pretty responsible people as a transitional power, after a fossil fuel. And I am predisposed to not want anything nuclear, but I want to know what the truth is.
Well, the nuclear power advocates say, first of all, once it's up and running, it doesn't emit carbon dioxide. Constructing them uses a lot. There's a lot in the construction process. A lot of cement is intensely carbon intensive to make, and they use a lot of cement and trucks and all of that. But once it's up and running, there's no carbon dioxide emissions. They also last a long time. So once you've made the original investment, the cost drops off over time. Another argument that's made, of course, is that it is 24/7, whereas solar and wind is intermittent, as we know. Now, those problems can be overcome with better storage of electricity, better transmission lines, but the nuclear advocates see this as a way of producing electricity without producing any carbon. So that's the biggest argument. I thought I saw somebody else, and then maybe one or two more. One.
Negative is waste fuel.
What's that?
What's the negative of nuclear?
I don't think I have to explain the negatives. The question was, what are the positives that are made for it? And bear in mind that the negatives are so great that private enterprise, we all believe in private enterprise, right? Private enterprise will touch it. Nowhere in the world will private enterprise invest big time in nuclear energy. It has to be government financed. So the only place where this is expanding is where you have governments that can make that decision without the will of the people. China, India, other communist countries, Abu Dhabi, Russia, Korea.
Japan just announced today.
That makes my case as far as people are overwhelmingly opposed. And you have a prime minister who's beholden to the big corporations, and he's determined to do that. So it's overriding public sentiment. This. If there was a vote, it would never happen. Yes, please.
Just two quick things. There was an article in today's Boston Globe saying that the ozone layer has improved as a result of international agreements in 1987 to reduce
fluorocarbons
produced by refrigerators and aerosol spray cans. And there is the picture, and it's allegedly improving. And I guess it's one of the few things of which that can be said about our global environment. But what I wanted to wonder is there a lot of very brainy, exceedingly well-informed people in this room to whom, are deeply aware that our planet is in trouble. But I wonder about the other 99% of our population, if we're just going to narrow this conversation to the United States. And for them, I think what they hear is a lot of white noise. They say, they may agree with you that yes, our planet is at risk and it's because of our own human activities. Ejecting filth into our atmosphere. But if you ask them, if you say, well, what should I do about it? Most of them will say, I can't do anything about it. It's overwhelming and we're doomed. But if I think of people in the know could begin to spell out to the rest of the 300 plus million people in our country what exactly we can do as individuals and together and as a lobbying force for a United States Department of Transportation, Department of Energy, and the big oil offenders, what exactly needs to happen, I think that might help our entire country move a little inch.
Yeah, well, all of that is true. Now, a few things. And nobody mentioned this here. Sunday's march in New York City is not the only People's Climate March on that day. There are going to be, maybe somebody in this room knows more than I do, but there are going to be equivalent marches in London, Paris, Berlin, Rio de Janeiro, Melbourne, New Delhi, maybe in Tokyo. So like I say, you know, and all of these will generate, and the one in New York City will generate media attention. So that's something. That's something that will raise the issue. But there are many, many NGOs and groups, maybe in this room, Union of Concerned Scientists and others, that are making this effort day in and day out. UCS is here in Cambridge. I think they're doing a very good job on the science side. So we have to support all of these efforts to get the word out. They're working very hard on developing a media campaign, especially to reach younger people. You're absolutely right, I agree. I see this meeting that we're having, I'm not to persuade you, but to hear each other's ideas and to develop a better argument, a better case to make what's going to work elsewhere in this country and elsewhere, how to develop a message that's going to be more effective. So that at least we can do here is improve our message, sharpen our message. And I hope that this succeeded in that. And I think that's a good moment to end this formal discussion. Who did I miss? Please.
Wasn't a question, it was actually directed towards you, that in the very beginning when you were laying out your argument about, and the last, the point three was about the only thing that will work, and obviously we're not going to get into how we get there, because that's huge. But would be to get international cooperation about how to do more efficient use of and equitable use of resources. I mean, what is your vision? Could you just speak for a few minutes of what that would look like? What's your vision of that?
Okay, well, our first credit goes to 350.org for making this an international day of protest. Maybe you know more about this than I do. Can you say more? I do know that there are these other marches. I don't know on what scale.
No, I meant how would we survive by equitably, more efficiently and equitably producing what we need to live?
Okay, well, somebody, our friend over here, made the very important point that we in this country consume twice as much energy per capita as Europeans. Now, I frankly think maybe it's bad of me, but I like the European lifestyle. I like walking in cities. I like taking trains. I like taking the Paris metro and so on. It's a more dense urban culture, but the public policies have been put in place that have made that possible.
And producing food with less water?
A whole host of they have deficiencies. Yes, but they could be overcome. But they are working on this. And we need to duplicate the kind of policies they have there to reduce their per capita. They're going down in per capita use of energy and in carbon emissions because of these policies. So we have to learn how to create
And the thing is, this is what's important. And I think more and more people in this country grasp this, that living in suburban sprawl is not a good quality of life. It destroys families. It makes kids, want to get into all kinds of trouble because there's nowhere to go. Fathers, mothers can't be with their children. It's a horrible way of life, if you ask me. And more and more people are coming to that conclusion. Young people, my students, only want to live in cities where there's all of this, cafes and bars and places to meet other young people, and they don't want cars. So it's cities like Seattle, Portland, Oregon, Portland, Maine, maybe to some degree, are promoting a more European-like lifestyle. Now, I know there'll be people who say, oh, that's socialistic, that's European, that's bad. But more and more people are voting with their feet in their pocketbook to choose that lifestyle. And the point is, it's not because they're more moralistic than other people, but because they see that's a more desirable way of life. Get rid of the goddamn car. If we had that choice, I would do without it. Most of us, if you had public transportation and could go by train, why have a car? You don't have a car in Paris or London, and we all, you don't have a car in Manhattan. It's insane. So, what I'm trying to say is, and this goes back to that point about the Chinese and Indians who want to duplicate, they want to duplicate that suburban life that we are more and more learning to reject. And we have to say that a more European lifestyle, less energy consuming, less resource consuming, is a superior way of life. It's better than living in those godforsaken outer suburbs and spending 2 hours a day, 3 or 4 hours commuting. It's a better way of life. That's what we have to do.
Mike, I wanted to make a quick announcement. There's going to be a workshop in New York Saturday morning. Michael Clare is speaking, Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report, and it's on war and climate change and capitalism and how those things are connected and how we have to do something about this.
Yeah. It's getting late. I saw your hand. Last comment.
I just want to say thank you very much for connecting the dots here,
yes.
Because that's a big part of the problem that we are up against. I want to remember that we had for so long 10 people sitting in a room, just trying to figure out how to get more people on board, and now we're looking at 200,000 plus people coming together. We never imagined this. There are 1,500 actually planned around the world on next Sunday. Worldtruth.org has some other numbers there. And what can you do? A lot of people ask us, what can I do as an individual? All these things are great, solar power for that, if we can afford that, obviously. We have lots of things going on. We're campaign focused in Massachusetts. We have 11 nodes around the state. We've built our organization, our group of volunteers to 4,000 plus around the state. Whatever you can do to connect the dots, like you've done, the research is amazing, and the fossil fuel companies have done a lot, put millions and millions of dollars into eliminating these issues. So connecting the dots. Any chance I get with people when it's 60 degrees in January and there are people are walking around in shorts, this is great. I say no, it's not, because it's led to climate change, health effects, peace and justice, whatever it is, connect the dots. People are willing to listen because we know things are changing and people want answers.
Yes.
Whatever we can do, divest it. Great campaign, wherever you went to college, things like this. There are so many things we can do. Go to our website, thriftymass.org. We can use everybody. The more we come together, the more we can stand up to the fossil fuel industry, the powerful, wealthy, Koch brothers, and everybody else. So it's the people. Thank you very much for doing the research.
I will look for you all on 79th Street on Sunday, a week from Sunday. So look for me, and thank you for coming, and I hope you found this useful.
Thank you.